A view from Tehran, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Some sanctions lifted, others imposed, and a prisoner exchange. It was a busy weekend in U.S.-Iran relations. And this Iranian says she's relieved.
Now we feel more secure. At least no Western country is going to attack us.
But can Iran live up to the terms of the nuclear deal that's now in force?
There's no way to deny that there are all kinds of ways to get around this. But the deal could still be a positive thing if it is fully enforced.
Plus, allegations of match fixing. Not in soccer, though. We're talking tennis.
If you were going to invent a sport which was purposefully designed for match fixing, the sport that you would invent would be called tennis.
Those stories ahead on The World. It's been a really intense few days for U.S.-Iranian relations. The nuclear deal was implemented. Iran poured concrete into a key reactor. The U.S. lifted economic sanctions. But the most dramatic development has to be the prisoner exchange negotiated by Tehran and Washington. Five Americans held by Iran were freed, and seven Iranians were released by the U.S. Robin Wright has written about that prisoner swap in The New Yorker. As a journalist and author, Wright has been covering Iran for years. She's also a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Robin Wright, you've talked to some of the key players on both sides in this deal, so I'm guessing you were not as surprised as the rest of us when the deal came down.
No, I wasn't.
How did it all work out?
Well, the United States has been talking about the Americans with the Iranians ever since the nuclear talks began. They talked about it on the sidelines of the meetings between Iran and the world's six major powers. But for a year, the talks went nowhere. So they both sides decided to set up a secret second channel, very controversial because this was beyond the purview of the foreign ministry in Iran, our normal interlocutors. The new channel involved a State Department official and a team from the Department of Justice, the intelligence community, and the FBI. On the Iranian side, the team was headed by a member of the Ministry of Internal Security, basically the intelligence operations inside Iran.
And is that sort of a good thing or bad thing from a negotiating point of view?
Well, it was uncharted territory for the United States. They haven't had this kind of contact with Iranians basically for 40 years. And this was beyond the traditional channels of the foreign ministry, where most foreign relations with most countries are carried out. But it was clear that the foreign ministry might not alone be able to bring to fruition any kind of swap, that they actually had to get the parties responsible for the pickups, the detentions, and the trials of the Americans on the Iranian side.
And it was coincidence that the prisoner exchange happened to be agreed upon very soon after the sanctions lifting.
Well, the talks were fraught from the very beginning, but in the aftermath of the nuclear deal agreed in July, the last thing that Secretary of State Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif discussed just before they parted was how important it was to bring closure the cases of both the Americans in Iran and the Iranians who were held in the United States. And from that moment on, the effort accelerated. Now, it still nearly collapsed three times because of a lot of complications, legal issues, a lot of hiccups along the way, including right up until the last day. It was expected to happen Friday, didn't happen until Saturday. But it was clear that as these efforts both matured, that they were going to, in the end, probably come to fruition at the same time, even though that was not the original intention.
Now, who were these seven Iranians who were released as part of the deal?
The seven Iranians were all involved in either sanctions-busting operations or in violations of the trade embargo imposed by the United States. The Iranians originally came to the Americans with a list of 40 Iranians they wanted to be pardoned. And in the end, the United States got it down to the seven who were prisoners here, and 14 who were fugitives and on the Interpol red list.
Let's move to the Americans who were released. I know you know one of them pretty well, Matthew Trevithick. He used to be a student of yours. Tell us about him.
Matthew actually worked for me as a research assistant after he graduated from college. And he then went on to work for 2 years at the American University in Sulaymaniyah, a city in Iraqi Kurdistan. And he then went on to work in Afghanistan at the American University of Kabul. He was a champion rower, and he also, while working at both places, built new rowing teams for the young in both Iraq and in Afghanistan. He'd actually been on vacation in Iran once and found it intriguing. And because he'd learned some Farsi while he was in Afghanistan, decided he wanted to gain a language proficiency. And so he enrolled in an intensive four-month language class in Tehran, of an institution affiliated with Tehran University. And he was just completing that course when he was detained.
Robin, have you been in touch with Matthew since he arrived home?
I've been in touch with his family, and they sent me a picture of Matt last night when he was out for dinner at his favorite burger joint in Boston.
Robin Wright, writer and journalist. She's also a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, and she has the full story on the Iran prisoner exchange in The New Yorker. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
As I mentioned earlier, news of the prisoner exchange coincided with another major development, the lifting of U.S. and European economic sanctions on Iran. It was part of the nuclear deal that Iran and Western powers reached back in the summer. Iran promised to take steps to scale down its nuclear program drastically, and in return, it would be relieved of the crippling sanctions. Those sanctions had a huge impact on Iranians. I asked Tehran resident Roya Sadat for her reaction to the news.
Well, I'm so happy, as most of the Iranians are. We've been waiting for this day, for the news and this day. So we're absolutely thrilled about it, and we are so hopeful and looking forward to it.
Practically, what impact will it have on you?
Personally, I'd like to see more relations with the world, and I'd like to be, in a secure country. I don't like war. I think most of the people don't like war, so now we feel more secure. At least no Western country is going to attack us. And also, we are hoping for more economic impact on our lives.
It's interesting, when I first asked you about how you were feeling, your first response was around sort of security, around now Iran is not a target and no war. It's funny because in our newsroom, we were thinking about kind of financial benefits or, easier trade, but your response was more about the security of Iran and Iranians.
Carol, maybe it goes back to my childhood. I was a child when the war started, the war between Iran and Iraq started. And I have always lived in Tehran. I wasn't in the war zone, but I had really, really bad days. And when I remember those days, I don't want to go back, to that time. So I think war is devastating. What I see happening in Syria now, it breaks my heart, and I don't want that to happen to my country, to my people. Of course, economy is important to every person everywhere in the world, but my security, feeling secure wherever I live, is more important to me. I live with my parents who are, seniors, and I have always been worried for them that if the war happens, how I can take care of them.
Roya, can you give me one anecdote about how sanctions had a direct impact on you or your friends or family?
Sure. For me, my father takes medications for his blood pressure and also for epilepsy. In 2011, when the sanctions were imposed, all my concerns and worries was that we couldn't get the medication for my father. So I ran into the drugstores and tried to buy as much as I could to store for my father, because I was really worried. And I saw a lot of other people looking for medication they needed for very, very severe illnesses. And that was horrible. And it was something that I wished the sanctions could have been lifted. And I remember once I was so angry that I said that Mr. Obama targeted the poor people in Iran, not the government, because I could see how people were, hopeless regarding finding the medicine.
What about your friends and family and neighbors? Have you been speaking to them?
Well, yeah. Well, we talk about it all the time. The Iranians talk about politics more than any other nations, I think. We talk about it at work, at the break time, in the taxi, and at our parties. So we talk about it all the time, and so we're really happy. We would like to interact with the world, and we would like to see more of the other people coming to our country. I think it will help a lot if we can, have more relations with the world.
Roya Sadat is a Tehran resident. Thanks, Roya.
Thank you, Carol.
Here in snow-covered Boston, it's hard to fathom, but in South America, parents are keeping their kids indoors to protect them from the sun. That's because of dangerously high UV levels. Reporter Simeon Tagle has been writing about this from Lima for our partners at Global Post. He says Peru and Bolivia will reach 17 or 18 on the UV index this week.
Just to explain that, 6 to 10 on the UV index is regarded as high, and doctors recommend you basically stay out of the sun at least from, say, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. when it gets to 11 or above.
And why are the UV levels so high right now in parts of South America?
Well, there's a range of factors. The first is, very obviously, this is the southern tropics, and at this time of year, the sun is almost directly overhead for much of the day. On top of that, you then have altitude. We have the Andes. It's the world's second highest mountain range. But then there are some other factors on top of that as well. One of them, just historically, is that the ozone layer everywhere in the world is thinner than it used to be. It's recovering since we had the Montreal Protocol in 1987, which banned the use of certain chemicals in aerosols and fridges and other things. But for the ozone layer to fully recover, that's going to take a decade. We're looking really at the second half of this century when it will be fully recovered. But then on top of that, there are some very distinct things going on in this part of the world right now.
One of them
is called the intertropical convergence zone, what sailors call the doldrums. And that's where winds from the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere collide. And some of the ozone, once it gets into the upper atmosphere, is being blown away very quickly from this part of Southern America. We then also have El Nino. And although El Nino means in some parts of the world more rain, in other parts it means less rain. And that means less clouds, which help to filter out the UV.
Yeah, sounds like sort of to use an overused phrase, it's kind of a perfect storm of characteristics that are making it so dangerous there. I know you've written that the authorities in South America are telling people to stay indoors during the middle of the day. You mentioned between 10 and 4. Are people actually doing that, going inside?
A lot of people aren't, is the short answer. Where the UV is highest, which is mainly in the altitude, a lot of people who work, frankly, I think they don't have any choice. They have to go out and work the fields during the day. But where the biggest danger, I think, for people is may not be at altitude, but down here in Lima. And that's because we're on the coast, so people are hitting the beach. A lot of people will be using sunblock, but there's plenty of people who aren't using sunblock and who are there on the beach right in the middle of the day.
You know, at this point in the U.S., there's been several decades of warning about skin cancer and the ill effects of sun exposure. Is that kind of public health message gotten around and effective in a place like Peru?
It's definitely getting around. The authorities and doctors and medical associations are warning about it, and it's in the media here. The fact is, though, that skin cancer levels seem to be rising. I say seem to be because neither Bolivia nor Peru actually compiles skin cancer numbers. But when you speak to dermatologists here, they all say, I'm seeing more and more cases of skin cancer than, say, 10 years ago. And I'm seeing people who are younger and younger, certainly both in Peru and Bolivia.
You mentioned the Montreal Protocol when a lot of these ozone-depleting chemicals were banned internationally. Why does a thin ozone layer continue to be a problem this many decades later?
Well, because it takes a while for the ozone to regenerate. It's a chemical that requires a chemical interaction to be produced. And the chemicals that destroy the ozone also don't just disappear. They last a while. So really, we're looking at between 2050 and 2070 for when we're expecting the ozone hole, or the ozone layer rather, to have fully recovered.
Simeon Tagle writes for our partner Global Post. Thanks a lot, Simeon.
Thank you, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. The effects of climate change are starting to make themselves clear just about everywhere. But one place where the changes are most dramatic is Greenland. The giant island holds the world's second largest ice sheet, and it's melting fast. Global warming is the big culprit, but scientists aren't so sure about a lot of the details. And they need to be to help figure out what might be ahead for the rest of us. Recently, The World's Ari Daniel visited Greenland with some folks who are trying to unlock parts of the mystery.
The breakfast is ordinary. Granola, yogurt, bread and jam. Everything else is anything but.
You pay $1 million bucks for a view like this. Pretty nice breakfast buffet, I guess, for sitting out here next to the ice sheet.
Gordon Hamilton, detective number one in our story, is sitting on the rocky rim of a glacier. Kind of figures, I mean, the man is a glaciologist from the University of Maine by way of Scotland. But this isn't just any glacier. It's the Helheim Glacier, one of Greenland's biggest, a 3-mile-wide river of ice, a modeling of grays, whites, and stunning blues that flows into Sirmalik Fjord on the island's southeast coast. We're on one side of that fjord. Across, on the other side, that's where it is, what drew us here, a horizontal stripe running the length of the fjord, about 600 feet above the ice.
I mean, everybody who's come here with me said, what's that line over there? And I said, well, that's where the glacier was in 2003. It's kind of like the signal clue that something really big had happened.
Hamilton calls this clue the bathtub ring.
It represents the former height of the glacier surface.
Helheim's surface sat right around that line for decades, maybe longer. But about a decade ago, in the span of just a couple of years, it dropped dramatically.
And what that means is that all that volume of ice from the current surface up to the height of that bathtub ring, it's now in the ocean.
And the question is why?
Why? Why did that happen, right?
And what it might mean for all of us. You see, it's not just Helheim. Most of Greenland is covered by a massive block of ice, so big it's difficult to imagine, even right here on the edge of it.
Look at this landscape. It's just, you can't take your eyes off it. It's gorgeous.
Helheim is just one of thousands of glaciers that drain that ice sheet into the sea. And right around the time this bathtub ring showed up, some of the other big glaciers also changed suddenly.
They retreated very quickly back up their fjords. Their flow speed doubled or tripled. And this had the effect of putting more icebergs into the ocean. And when you put icebergs into the ocean, you cause sea levels to rise.
So what happened here? To find our next clue requires going airborne.
Is it clear on your side? Yeah, it's clear.
One perk of being a glaciologist is the helicopter rides. This one's taking us a few miles down the fjord beyond the glacier's terminus. The pilot's got the thing hovering like 50 feet above the water below. There are icebergs the size of football stadiums in every direction.
So, open the doors, open the doors.
Daniel Sulak, a graduate student from the University of Oregon, slides the chopper door to one side. It's okay, he's roped in. He sits on the floor with a spool of copper wire that's got a thermometer on one end.
Okay, prepare for launch. Launch probe.
Sulak shoots the probe into the water.
Did you see this eye? The data's plotting on the screen as it drops through the ocean.
I lean over Hamilton's shoulder and watch the temperature plot in real time on a screen. It's a hair colder than 0 degrees Celsius near the surface, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, the freezing point of fresh water. But it's not frozen because salt water freezes at about minus 2 Celsius. As the probe goes deeper, the water gets even colder, but then it gets warmer again. And at the bottom of the fjord,
temperature is 4.04 degrees centigrade.
That's 39 degrees Fahrenheit, warm enough to melt glacial ice.
We think it's this water that's coming into contact with the edge of the ice sheet and causing the rapid melting of the outlet glaciers.
For Hamilton, it's a key clue. We know that some of Greenland's ice is melting due to warm air overhead, and he can't be sure because no one was measuring the water temperature here a decade ago, but Hamilton thinks warming water below was probably what triggered Helheim's dramatic change. Of course, that answer leads us smack into another question. Where's all this warm water coming from?
Coming up on the crane.
60 miles down the Sirmalik Fjord near its mouth, ocean engineer Will Ostrom stands aboard the Adolf Jensen, a converted fishing trawler. He's just hauled in a temperature and salinity recorder from the iceberg-clotted water. It takes skill to navigate the slow-moving ship, but challenging as it is, this is where the ship must be.
What we're doing here is understanding how the glacier talks to the ocean and the ocean talks to the glacier.
Fiamma Stranio, our second detective, is using an array of instruments to eavesdrop on that conversation. She's a physical oceanographer originally from Italy and now at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Stranio always knew that warm water from farther south in the Atlantic flows along the coast of Greenland. She also knew that climate change is helping make that water even warmer than it used to be. But until a few years ago, she thought that water stayed out of the fjords.
We had expected that we'd find some structural barriers where the fjord starts so that the waters couldn't get in. But instead, we found these deep troughs. The fjord was wide open.
And it was the same for others, nothing to keep the warming water out of the fjords. This at least partly answers Gordon Hamilton's question, how that warm water is getting to the base of the glaciers. But there are still other big questions, like why did the glacier drop so suddenly a decade ago? Hamilton says the evidence suggests there's a kind of tipping point, that glaciers like Helheim can remain stable in near-freezing water, but that even a little more heat in the water can destabilize them. Now, that doesn't explain why Helheim seems to have restabilized. It also doesn't tell us whether or when it'll get hit with another massive melt. But Fiamastranio says this fjord and its glacier are fairly typical.
What we found was that these fjords, not just this one, but all the big fjords around Greenland, are filled with these warm Atlantic waters.
And she says one thing is quite clear.
What's happening in this fjord does not stay in this fjord.
Or any other fjord up here. There's a ton of ice in Greenland, trillions of tons, actually, enough to raise global sea levels 21 feet if all of it were to melt. No one can say yet how quickly that will happen, but Stranio says it's vital to learn as much as possible, and fast.
There's no doubt that sea level will rise in a warming planet, but what is important is to understand how quickly it will rise. We need to know this so that we can plan.
For Stranio, that means continuing to probe the waters here for subtle changes in temperature, salinity, even rare gases that provide telltale signs of where different patches of water are coming from. For Gordon Hamilton, it also means intently watching the glacier itself and its surface from a vantage point well above the bathtub ring. That's where he and a team of engineers are drilling and bolting some serious machinery into a flat patch of rock. They're installing a special kind of laser that will take precise measurements of the terminus over the next year.
By having a high-resolution view of the glacier's behavior and a high-resolution view of the ocean's behavior, we can start to link these two separate systems together and figure out what is the change in one system that causes the change in the other.
So, still lots of mysteries to be solved up here. But there's one thing that's just not a mystery. Greenland matters. To all of us. For The World, Ari Daniel, near Helheim Glacier, Greenland.
Ari's report was produced with help from our WGBH partners at NOVA and the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Tomorrow, going small to probe some of Greenland's big questions. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. It's wildflower season in Israel, and it's beautiful. But please, hands off.
Hey, guys, if all of us will keep on picking flowers, there might be no left here, some flowers for the next generation. You like the flowers? Great. Keep on liking them and love them. Just do it in a different way.
That story's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Four Iranian Americans were released by Iran over the weekend as part of a prisoner swap with the United States. One of those released reportedly chose to remain in Iran. The other three were flown to Germany for medical checkups and to be reunited with their families. That group includes Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian. He was held for 545 days in Tehran's infamous Evin prison. For anyone who's seen the inside of that jail, the ordeal isn't easily forgotten. Washington-based Iranian academic Hale Asfandiari was held there, too. She was in solitary confinement for 105 days back in 2007. Today, I asked her how she felt when she heard the news of the release.
I was elated. I have been waiting for the news from the first day they arrested Jason and, of course, the other two Iranian Americans. So I think it's the best thing that could have happened.
You have a particular connection to this story. You experienced Evin prison yourself. Would you remember how you felt when you were released in 2007?
You know, at first I didn't believe it because they had promised to release me earlier, but they never kept their word. So when they told me that I can go home, I thought it's one of their cruel jokes. But lo and behold, I was freed, but as I was leaving the prison, I was told that they would never let me leave the country. So that was a shock to me because my family was in the United States. So I thought, okay, this is a first step. They are going to keep me in Iran. They always play these really cruel jokes in the last minute.
Can you imagine what these Americans, their daily life was like in Evin prison based on your own experience?
Well, look, the prison, I mean, I was told that Jason was not treated well. So probably this means very harsh interrogation, hopefully not physical, you know, abuse, but long hours of interrogation, waking you up in the middle of the night and when you are disoriented and dragging you for another interrogation. He had to appear in court several times and given the sentence. I mean, to be very frank with you, Evin is a horrible place to be because you never know what will happen to you. And, you know, you usually don't have any access to neither family visit. I think I had one family visit. They constantly hammer into your head that nobody cares about you outside prison. If you only cooperate, if you only confess, then we will help you to get out. And they never help you to get out.
There are some people who are criticizing President Obama for this exchange of seven Iranian and Iranian-Americans who were convicted for violating U.S. sanctions. For these Americans who've been released, who really didn't do anything wrong, do you think the swap was the right thing to do?
Look, I just get very upset when people criticize a swap or any resolution to get prisoners, especially who are innocent, out of Evin. So it's easy said if you sit in the comfort of your house in Washington and start criticizing the administration. Secondly, the people, the Iranians who were released were not terrorists, and they were Iranian Americans. So President Obama basically pardoned these, except one who was Iranian, six Americans. And to get those three Americans to leave the country. So, you know, it's not fair to criticize the president. It's neither the first time nor the last time. And these people who criticize the swap don't have a notion what it means to be cooped in a cell day in, day out. In Jason's case, for almost 18 months, you know, where you don't have an idea what day it is, what the time is. You know, the third time I saw the moon, I noticed it has been almost 3 months that I was kept in Evin. So it's easy to sit here and criticize. I'm all for it. I think the administration worked a whole year and longer to get to this deal.
Hale Asfandiari is with the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The prisoner exchange over the weekend came just as Western economic sanctions on Iran were being lifted. That's one of the steps called for in the nuclear deal with Iran that's now being implemented. And it means Tehran can now start returning to the global financial system. But at the same time, the Obama administration has also just announced new sanctions against Iran. They target the Iranian ballistic missile program. To explain how all this works, we've got Matthew Levitt on the line. He's with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also a former official of the U.S. Treasury Department. Matthew, to start with, what triggered these new missile sanctions?
These new missile sanctions were triggered by ballistic missile tests that Iran conducted in the fall and that the UN Monitoring Committee just in December determined was in fact an explicit violation of UN Security Council resolutions. The administration had announced they were going to do it last week, but then it apparently got caught up in this prisoner exchange business, and so they did it now, right after the day after implementation day.
So what do these new sanctions do, and how are they different from the nuclear sanctions on Iran that were just lifted?
Well, they do very little, and it's not the sanction itself, the persons or companies that are sanctioned, that really are important here. What's important is the symbol that when the administration says it intends to continue to pursue sanctions for illicit Iranian activity under sanctions that still exist, it's serious about doing that. The sanctions that have been removed are all of the proliferation sanctions and many of the other financial sanctions. But what remain in place are sanctions on Iran's other illicit conduct, specifically support for terrorism, human rights violations, and ballistic missile production.
So what happens when an individual is targeted, say in the case of these sanctions that were just announced? What changes for the people having sanctions imposed on them? What can't they do now?
First of all, there's a naming and shaming element here. Second of all, they can't do business with the United States. But most importantly, the secondary sanctions remain. And that means that foreigners, say European banks, Asian banks, cannot do business with these entities if they want to continue doing business with the United States, having access to dollars, etc. And that makes it, even though this is really a unilateral action, it gives a kind of multilateral or international effect.
Republicans in the U.S. have made a lot of noise about the billions of dollars of frozen funds now being released to Iran. But there seems to be some confusion about where this money is coming from. Is this actual Iranian money frozen in U.S. accounts?
It does include some money that's been frozen in U.S. accounts. It includes other funds as well. The most important thing to understand is that it's not all liquid funds. It's not money you have, you know, in your wallet ready to spend. Some of it has been is already being used for business dealings, say, in China. And there's been a lot of hype about the amount of money. You've seen or heard probably numbers in the $100 billion, $150 billion. And the number seems to be much closer to about $56 billion. Still a huge amount of money, but much less than some are saying.
Now, you're somebody who has followed this issue for a long time and really know the ins and outs of sanctions. And when you look at this deal and you look at kind of how things have moved forward over the weekend, are you thinking, okay, this looks solid? Or are you thinking, no, there's all sorts of leaks, there's all sorts of ways to get around this?
There's no way to deny that there are all kinds of ways to get around this. But the deal could still be a positive thing if it is fully, fully enforced. There are so many ways to evade sanctions and to do things that we may not be able to pick up on. You know, the fact is intelligence is never perfect. And so there's always a danger when a country like Iran, that is still considered the foremost state sponsor of terrorism, is still holding Americans, is fomenting instability across the Middle East, especially in Syria, but beyond, that they're going to try and cheat. I think there's no question. And you cannot guarantee that we will know of all that cheating. So we're going to have to be extremely vigilant in how we pursue existing sanctions and how we array our collection platforms for intelligence to be able to be on top of what they are and are not doing.
Matthew Levitt is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
It's winter in the Northern Hemisphere, and here in Boston, that means snow. In Israel, it means wildflower season. Yep, entire hillsides covered in colorful blooms. The thing is, years ago, Israel's wildflowers were actually under threat of extinction. People were picking way too many of them. But they were saved thanks to a public service campaign that got Israelis to stop. Daniel Estrin has a story from Jerusalem.
Back in the old days, years ago, everyone in Israel picked wildflowers. Take one typical Israeli of that generation, 77-year-old Israela Hargil.
Born 1938.
Wildflowers meant a lot to Israela. As a little girl back in Poland, she used to go flower picking with her parents. Then World War II broke out. She survived the Holocaust hiding in a Polish family's home. Going out to pick flowers was out of the question. It was just way too dangerous. After the war ended, she moved to Israel, where she could pick as many flowers as she liked. And picking flowers in Israel felt symbolic, not just to her peers too. And also to Tali, her daughter.
You were in awe when you saw these colorful flowers. And it was an emblem or a symbol of the
recreation.
Rebirth.
Of the country, of everything.
Of the state of Israel. I mean, a Jewish country. And it was kind of proof that things are going well, you know.
I remember mainly one morning, very early, I walked up Tali. She was about 4. We got up quickly and went out on a hill, and we sat there quietly watching the sunrise. Then we noticed that the whole hill was covered with wild flowers. So we started picking up the flowers and started weaving a crown.
And every birthday I had a crown like
every
that.
Every single birthday,
a crown of wild flowers.
This was not just their private ritual. In the country's early years, picking wildflowers was a national pastime. It was a way Israelis showed their love of the land. They would uproot the flowers to feel rooted to their homeland. Arabs in the country picked wildflowers too, and Christian pilgrims used to buy albums of pressed wildflowers as a Holy Land souvenir. Benny Fierst, who works at Israel's Ministry of Environmental Protection, has done a lot of research about this.
Nobody thought that there's a problem. Nobody thought that, hey, guys, if all of us will keep on picking flowers, there might be no left here, some flowers for the next generation.
But there was one man who did realize there was a problem. Uzi Paz. Back in the 60s, Uzi helped found Israel's Society for the Protection of Nature. And he likes to think of himself as the man who saved Israel's wildflowers from extinction, along with a few other key people. They realized if people kept picking Israel's flowers at the rate they were picking them, they would simply disappear. So they launched a campaign to save Israel's wildflowers. Step one, convince the government to make picking illegal. The way Uzi remembers that campaign sounds a lot like an episode of House of Cards, political wheeling and dealing to persuade key lawmakers to support the legislation. And in August 1963, wildflower picking was outlawed. But given the popularity of picking wildflowers, a law was not going to be enough. Uzi printed 30,000 colorful posters with a simple message, "Protect the wildflowers." And people hung them everywhere, in government buildings, in health clinics, in banks. Before long, everyone joined the party. The Israeli lottery printed lottery tickets with images of protected wildflowers. A gift manufacturer made a wildflower-themed card game. There was even a popular song about the law. It's called Waltz for the Protection of the Flora. It's astonishing just how successful this campaign was. In the decades since, there have been plenty of public service campaigns in Israel to get people to change their behavior. There are radio ads every single hour telling Israelis to drive safely. And still, they don't.
Why was this campaign so successful when so many other campaigns in Israel have not been as successful?
The basic thing that the campaign asks from the Israelis was very simple.
That's Benny Fierst again from the Ministry of Environmental Protection.
You like the flowers? Great. Keep on liking them and love them. Just do it in a different way. It's amazing. It changed the Israeli behavior and the Israeli ethics of people to their land.
It's been more than half a century since Israel outlawed wildflower picking. Today, you just don't do it.
Daniel Estrin reporting from Jerusalem. An extended version first aired on Israel Story, a podcast produced in partnership by Tablet Magazine and PRX. How easy is it to throw a match in tennis? That's just ahead, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We know about widespread doping in cycling and about the multi-million-dollar bribes swirling around soccer's governing body. Now there are allegations of match-fixing in tennis, possibly involving some top-level players. BuzzFeed News and our partners at the BBC are reporting on this. To Richard Ings, it's no surprise. For years, he led the anti-corruption program at the Association of Tennis Professionals, or ATP.
Well, if you were going to invent a sport which was purposefully designed for match fixing, the sport that you would invent would be called tennis. And I say that because tennis as an individual sport only requires the participation of one individual to fix the match. The opponent need not know that the match is being fixed. The fans and the public need not know. And with so many matches being played all over the world, the opportunity for fixing matches such as this is quite widespread.
Why fix a match? Why would a player want to do that?
Well, that's the age-old question. Why do people break rules? We've seen in multiple sports, and cricket is a great example, or even baseball, where we've seen athletes involved in fixing competition. Now, tennis is no different. There are those who will break rules, and where there's motive and where there's opportunity, such corruption can take place.
But what's this investigation showing was in it for the players who were allegedly fixing the games? Was it huge monetary rewards?
Well, the amount of money that's being bet on professional tennis, both men's and women's tennis globally, is measured in the hundreds of billions of dollars annually. And whilst prize money at tournaments is quite high, it is possible that you can make more money from betting on yourself to lose in the first round of a tournament than you could if you played really long and hard and actually got through and won the entire tournament. For most people, that will be no incentive to cheat, but there will be those who will cut corners and there will be those who will break rules.
You were a tennis umpire. Did anyone ever approach you to fix a match or to call a serve in instead of out?
No. I was a tennis umpire through the early 90s. And this is an ancient era in professional tennis, before the internet and before a lot of these problems really, really came to the fore.
You know, I saw Roger Federer quoted this weekend as saying, you know, show me the name, show me the evidence. He doesn't seem terribly concerned about this. In what you've read and seen so far, does this report by BuzzFeed and BBC concern you?
Well, I've got a long history of looking at anti-corruption issues in the sport of tennis, and there are matches that are fixed. Is it widespread? Who knows? But what we do know is it's consistent. It happens at various levels within the sport. There are thousands of players playing professional tennis on the men's and women's tour, and there are those who may take an opportunity to fix a match for their own personal benefit. So it exists. We need to accept that. It's ongoing. It happens. And the challenge is to put in place programs which will never eradicate it, but to do everything possible to detect it and penalize those who break rules.
Richard Ings is the former head of the Anti-Corruption Program at the Association of Tennis Professionals, or ATP. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Finally today, the story of a shadowy police unit in Sicily called the Caturandi, or the Catchers. These officers go after the mafia and make arrests, and they've nabbed some of Sicily's biggest mobsters now behind bars, like the notoriously brutal Giovanni Brusca. We'll hear about him in a minute. The Catchers' job is very dangerous, so they wear ski masks in public to protect their identity. Reporter Max Paradiso interviewed one veteran officer who wants to be known only as IMD.
To this very moment, not a lot of people know who he is and what he does. His wife, for example, he met his wife a long time ago in 1996. She didn't know what he was doing, and he said, I'm working at the passport office. But one day, they were arresting Brusca, the mobster, and his wife saw a rear end, shall we say it, a bottom on TV. She recognized that bottom, and she called him up, and she said, I recognize your bottom on TV. You don't work at the passport office. So it's funny. But he cannot say anything to anybody, what he does, because you can get death threats. People spit you in the face just because you're a police officer in Sicily. So, it's hard.
You mentioned this Brusca case. Can you give us a kind of short synopsis of that case and why it was so important?
Brusca was the guy that actually pushed the button that made, I think, a mile of highway just blow up to kill a judge. He killed an 11-year-old kid in acid. He dissolved him in acid just because he didn't want another family to bury his body. This guy was brutal. He was called the pig, the swine, the ammazza cristiani, the Christian killer. What happened was that this Brusca was so brutal, so angry, and so. But when they got him, this guy started weeping, started crying, and nobody knew what to do. They just arrested him, handcuffed him, and they brought him to jail.
And they got him just by kind of listening in and tracking him for a long period of time?
They tracked him, they tailed him, they wiretapped him for 2 years, And they were listening to his life, how he conceived his child. Well, not how. Everybody knows how to conceive a child. But his life, his family issues. And then at some point they arrested him and he started weeping.
So IMG's unit is known, it's known as the Catchers. How effective have they been in combating the mafia?
Well, quite a lot, I would say. I mean, over the past 10 years, the Catturandi and to some extent the government helped apprehend a lot of mobsters. They've been successful. I mean, we don't see any bombs blasting anymore in Palermo. I think that's a good thing.
So how does the mafia conduct itself now, if not through kind of bombings and kidnappings? What kind of crime are they involved in?
Well, IMD told me that mafia now operates in subtle ways. They don't bomb anymore. They just make calls. So IMD told me the story. There's one guy somewhere that wakes up in the morning and just gets the phone and calls a woman. The woman is sick and he says, well, I know a doctor back in Milan. I'll take care of the expenses. Just go there and get cured. And he calls another guy and he says, well, I know you lost your job. Why don't you come back in my residence? I got some gardening to do. Bring your kid. And he keeps on doing this thing like all day long, 365. And then an election comes and this guy calls them up all together and says, do you remember the favor that I did to you? Well, I need a favor now. And so politicians get elected. I'm not saying, and IMD, I'm sure he's not saying that all politicians that get elected are mafioso, but you cannot see the difference anymore. It's shadowy.
Max Paradiso reported on Sicily's mafia catchers for our partners at the BBC. And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman's back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.